The following podcast was recorded live at the Seattle Central Library. It was presented by the Washington Center for the Book with the Elliott Bay Book Company. Podcasts and the library's Fall Author Series are made possible through the generous support of the Seattle Public Library Foundation, Seattle Post Intelligencer, and Safeco Insurance Foundation. For more information on these podcasts, please visit our website, www.spl.org. Alice Schroeder visited the Seattle Public Library October 17, 2008, to talk about her new book, The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. She joined in conversation with Seattle Channel host C.R. Douglas. Good evening. I'm Chris Higashi. I'm the program manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Thank you all for joining us for this afternoon's event with Alice Schroeder, the author of a new biography of Warren Buffett. Thanks first to Ms. Schroeder's publisher and Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to host this event, to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer for generous promotional support for library programs, to Safeco Insurance Foundation for sponsoring our fall author series, and finally to the Seattle Public Library Foundation, whose support makes possible so many of our free library programs. Today's program is being filmed by the Seattle Channel for later broadcast. It will broadcast many, many times. It's also being recorded for library podcast. You can subscribe to free podcasts on the library's website, spl.org. So now I'm going to turn things over to our moderator for today, Seattle Channel host and producer, C.R. Douglas.
Well, we are all pleased to have Alice Schroeder here in Seattle. She will make many stops throughout America on this book tour, but none will be quite as special, I think, as her visit here today. Seattle, after all, is the only other place in America that has a person whose wealth rivals Warren Buffett's. Indeed, just a few weeks back, our guy was on top of the Forbes list. But the market meltdown has not been as good to Microsoft as it was to Berkshire, and so Warren in the last couple of weeks has regained his position as the number one most wealthy person in the country and the world. There is, of course, one other thing that makes Seattle special, and unlike any other place that Alice will visit on this tour, and that is that the vast majority of the wealth that she has so diligently chronicled in this book will make its way to our city, through our city, before reaching its final destination. Many of you know that Warren Buffett has directed that most of his fortune flow to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Put simply, the money was made in Omaha, but it will be spent in Seattle. And we're happy about that. We will benefit, at least partially, from that, of course, though it's not all going here. It will employ a bunch of people, and a lot of decisions will be made in Seattle with this wealth. And that means we have as good a reason as any to be as interested in how this vast fortune was accumulated. The Warren Buffett story has been written by others, but never in quite the way that Alice Schroeder has written it. She met Warren Buffett when she was an analyst with Morgan Stanley on Wall Street. She knew him, she was intrigued by him, and she wanted to document him. What sets her apart from the other authors of this story is that he fully cooperated with her and directed those around him to do so also. Her access was unprecedented. And we are pleased to have access to her today. So join me in welcoming the author of Warren Buffett, and the Business of Life, titled The Snowball, Alice Schroeder. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you met him when you were an analyst at Morgan Stanley.
I was at Payne Webber at the time. I came to Morgan Stanley a couple years later. In 1998 was when I met him, and I was working on Wall Street at that time. I'd been there for 5 years.
And what about Berkshire intrigued you?
Berkshire Hathaway was the most complicated company, essentially, in America. It was a holding company for a lot of other different kinds of businesses. And it acquired a big insurance company, General Re, that I followed, the stock that I followed. And so it suddenly became mostly an insurance company. And that was my industry that I followed.
And so how did you get from sort of following the industry to somehow being in this inner circle where he's giving you all this access and saying, write my story?
Well, as an analyst, he decided to work with me, you know, and talk to me, which he had never done with anyone before. And so, you know, once a year, I would go out to Omaha. I would meet with him for half a day. Then I would talk to him on the phone periodically. And we started to get to know each other and have a professional relationship. So by 2003, he had gotten, I guess, comfortable with me, my style. He liked my research. And he always said he liked the way that I wrote. In 2003, I had the idea for this book, and I proposed that he write it.
But he, in other words, Warren, write your life story.
Yes, yes. And Warren said, I don't want to write a book. Who do you think should do it? And I said, well, I guess I'm the only person who would ever come up with this particular idea, which was not just a memoir, but one that incorporated all of his unusual ideas. You know, why did he become a liberal Democrat after having been born a conservative Republican? All of these kinds of things.
And so here's Alice Schroeder never having written a book in your life, and suddenly you're being given this opportunity to write the Warren Buffett story.
That's right. And he said, I'll cooperate with you if you do it, which meant, you know, that I could interview him. He'd never done an interview with an author before.
There have been some other biographies of him, and they seem to have had some access, but no, you're saying no access.
No one's ever interviewed him who's written a book about him. I think he may have given some photographs out, but no interviews.
How much time did you spend with him?
I spent about 2,000 hours with him in total, of which about 300 ended up being in recorded interviews.
And how much time did you spend interviewing those around him?
There were about 250 other people that I interviewed, and those were ranged from business colleagues to his family. I spent a lot of time with his sisters, his two sisters, his kids, and his close business colleagues. Some of those interviews lasted for days or even a week or more.
And so now the question people want to know is, what does he think of your product? I mean, he's a reader. I assume he's read it.
He's read it.
What's his review?
He said it's well written, and he said that I treated him better than he deserved. I think that I treated him fairly, that it's an objective book, but he's typically self-deprecating.
There's this great story that really opens the book where one of your first meetings, she sits down with Warren, and he says, Alice, you're going to interview me, I'll give you all this access, and you're going to interview all my friends, and if the story ever conflicts, use the less flattering version. I mean, kind of an amazing encapsulation of this guy.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, he did not want a whitewashed story.
Yes, he didn't want a whitewashed story, and he also knew, I think, that if he tried to have a flattering story, it would probably backfire. You know, that, you know, he wanted a version. He told me he wanted to reconcile his public and private self.
And did he expect that you went quite so far? I mean, we will get into this, but this goes into his marriage, his mistress, his other women in his life. I mean, this is a guy it's been unconventional. Let's put it that way. Did he expect that much of the story to come out?
I don't know what he expected, because he told me I could write anything I wanted. And so I never said, Warren, what do you expect? But I think that anybody, if they were in this position and they said, you know, I want my life story told, there are no limits. 5 years later, if the book were handed to you and you saw someone's opinion, a judgment of your life, and they'd been digging for 5 years researching you, I think it would be a very vulnerable moment. And I think it's unlikely you would expect everything that you read to be in there after 5 years of someone researching your life.
But do you think there was this point, I kind of get the sense that everything this guy does is meant to send a signal, is meant to teach. Every action seems to have that. Is it the case that by 78 years old or whatever he is now, that he meant the world to be taught something about now having his life story told? I mean, nothing this guy does is not deliberate.
There is something about a book that is enduring. And he's written his shareholder letters for years, and they have immense value. And he's often said, I'm writing my book in installments through my shareholder letters. But while they're permanent, and of course they're on the internet, there's something about a book that is forever. And he sees himself as a teacher, and his legacy as his ideas. This book and his life story are in part a way of immortalizing him in a different way than you could through any other medium.
Let's go to the beginning. I mean, back when he was really young, was it obvious this kid was interested in money?
Yes. Yes. At the age of six, he was a tough little businessman.
I mean, he sold gum. He sold Coca-Cola. He had a paper route.
He did. And, you know, the first story he told me was about the gum when he said, I remember a woman named Virginia McCoubry, and I sold gum for a nickel, and she wanted to buy one stick. She wanted to spend a penny with me. And he resented, you know, this woman. To this day, it irks him, you know, and he said, I've got my principles. We don't break up packs of gum. You know, this was his attitude at age six.
He had that business acumen back then.
Absolutely.
He was, you tell a story that he memorized license plates. What was that about? And what does that tell you about Warren Buffett?
He and his friend used to sit in their neighborhood, and they would watch the cars go by on Military Avenue, and they would take the license plates down, and they took reams and reams of license plates down, and their parents thought this was very strange. And they had a theory, because the neighborhood was a cul-de-sac, and there was a bank in it. And they thought that if that bank were ever robbed, somewhere in those reams of license plate numbers would be the license plate number of the robbers, and they would have the key to solving the crime. So Warren is a collector, and he was collecting numbers. He has this dramatic flair, and he has this ability to think forward and ask himself, and then what would happen? And he was showing all of that, even as a child.
Was he also trying to, you know, calculate the probabilities of certain numbers coming up and letters and license plates?
He may have been, because he had that handicapping idea very early on, and he was always thinking in terms of probabilities about just about everything. So, yeah.
Lest any of you are parents and you worry about whether your young, you know, Sally or Bobby can grow up to be a billionaire, Warren Buffett had a, it seems to me, a little bit of a delinquent childhood. He was a shoplifter. He acted out. He was getting C's and D's in school. I mean, what was going on?
His parents moved to Washington when his father was elected to Congress. And Warren was very angry at having to move, but he didn't know how to express that, so he acted it out. And he ran away from home with his friends, and then he began shoplifting at Sears. And he liked playing golf at the time, so what he stole was golf balls. He stole hundreds of golf balls, and he kept them in this big orange sack in his closet. And the sack kept growing and growing, and he kept making up this explanation for his parents about how the father of a friend of his had died, and they kept finding these golf balls, and his friend kept giving them to him. And he knew his parents didn't believe him, but, you know. And finally, his father threatened to take away his paper route, because his grades were so bad and his behavior so bad that they would not let him graduate with his class from junior high.
And taking away his paper out meant taking away a source of income. That sort of registered quickly with him.
He cared more about his money and source of money than anything else.
So when did he finally clean up his act?
Well, in high school, he clearly had changed, although one of his friends told me that some of the shoplifting did continue a little bit into high school, but he had clearly changed, and he was a businessman in high school.
How much was he worth when he graduated from high school?
He had $5,000 when he graduated from high school.
Which would have been what now?
Oh, more than $50,000 now.
Okay, so that's a big chunk for a kid.
Yes.
And this is not a gift. This was not daddy's allowance. This was a start from scratch bank account.
As far as I know, the only money ever given him was $20 in a passbook savings account when he was very young. And all the rest he earned.
What were his parents like?
His father was a very rigid man. He was a very principled man. I don't think he was particularly warm, but he was very honorable. And Warren and his sisters got a very strong sense of honesty and integrity from Howard Buffett. His mother was someone who was needed social approval and also berated the children. There was something in her. I'm not a psychiatrist, but she would turn on the children on a moment's notice and scream at them about how worthless they were and detail all their faults. And then at the end, she'd say, "I'm glad we've had this little talk," and just...
I mean, she was an abusive mother.
She was abusive, yes.
What did he tell you about his relationship with her?
He said that it made him what he is, that he was broken by it, and it couldn't be repaired. And he is very thin-skinned, very, very sensitive to criticism, avoids confrontation at all costs, has built a life that enables him to avoid confrontation. And he's also very, very careful. He never criticizes anyone else.
He does seem to idolize his father. I know his father's pictures in his office. Talks about him a lot. Never talks about his mother.
No. He will deflect the conversation away from his mother if you bring her up. And yet, he has a very sophisticated understanding of his mother. His mother had a terrible life. His mother grew up in a family where she had to go to work as a very young child running a printing press. Her own mother and grandmother were institutionalized with what may have been bipolar disorder. Her mother was physically abusive to her father and sister. So it's easy to understand that, you know, she wasn't just a monster that came out of nowhere. There was a history there, and she had a really hard life, and Warren understands that.
So it wasn't as though this guy came from an easy background.
Right.
His father, we should say, however, was a member of Congress. I mean, this wasn't... it was also a house that had some prestige and had some honor, though not much wealth.
Yes, Howard Buffett actually took the family from being tradespeople, grocers in Omaha, to the upper middle class. He became a stockbroker, and during the Great Depression, when the world was falling apart around them, he built a very successful business. They moved into this lovely Tudor house. They got a new car, just as other people were becoming poorer and poorer.
And lest you think when your kids get to college and they're not performing well that it's over, that wasn't even the case with Warren. I mean, from your book, you talk about, I mean, he didn't flunk out of Wharton, but he basically left in a very unceremonious way, having made no real impression. And then what? Went to a couple other colleges.
Yes, he didn't like college. He didn't want to go there. At Penn, he spent most of his time playing ping pong. He coasted through the classes because he felt the school was easy. He would get a textbook, read it, toss it. But at the same time, he values learning, but he did not value formal education at all. And so he went to the University of Nebraska. He got his degree there. But at the same time, you know, there were a few classes that interested him intellectually, but he didn't really care about the degree.
I mean, was it finally when he got to Columbia and the sort of famed investor, Ben Graham, that he really clicked as a person?
Yes. He wanted to go to Harvard Graduate School of Business. And that may have been something to do with his father, who lost the only election to Congress that he ever lost. And then his career suffered. And Warren, I think, had a little bit of something to prove. He tried to get into Harvard. Graduate school didn't succeed. Went to Columbia instead and encountered Ben Graham. And they were a pair who were made for each other.
And that really got Warren on the track of, I'm going to be an investor. I'm going to be a stock picker.
Ben Graham had the method that he adopted that made him who he is. Warren had wanted to work in the stock market since he was at least 10 years old because his father was a stockbroker, but he was always searching for a system. And he tried technical analysis. He tried different systems. They didn't work. But when he met Ben Graham, it was like he emerged from a cave and the sun was shining because Ben Graham taught value investing. It was a fundamental way to look at stocks, and Warren's world changed.
So he didn't really learn it from his father, who was a stockbroker.
Right. That's right. His father mostly sold bonds, railroad bonds, very conservative investments, things that were really safe because the family had that depression. You know, Warren grew up in the Depression, and Howard was successful, but there wasn't a system. There wasn't a thought process other than just very safe, cautious.
But I guess there's some assumption that if his father was not in the business, it might not have turned out the way it did. Even though that wasn't his ultimate teacher, that was a very early impression.
It was clearly an early impression, and Warren was starting up little businesses when he was a child, like the newspaper or the pinball. He's got an entrepreneurial streak, so who knows what would have happened, you know, if he hadn't had that early exposure to the stock market.
He rather struck out with women as a child, didn't he?
He was not successful with girls. No.
They said no every time he asked them to the dance.
They did, and the few dates he had were uniformly disastrous.
And what was he, just too awkward?
He was awkward, and he tended to talk like a machine gun to try to cover that up, or he would grunt.
That can't be attractive.
Words would fail him, and he would begin to grunt because he was so shy and insecure.
So then Susie Buffett, this woman he married, and I think for 55 years or so, they had an unconventional but ultimately rewarding marriage. What the heck did she see in him? They're both, what, he's 21, she's 20, she's 19, something like that.
Susie Buffett was in love with somebody else when they met. And she wanted to marry a young man named Milton Brown. Milton was Jewish. Susie had this great love for people who were disadvantaged or needed her in some way. There was a great deal of racial prejudice and bigotry in Omaha at the time. And her father liked Warren. And Warren managed to convince both Susie's father and Susie that he was so fragile and needed so much taken care of. He said, I was Jewish enough for Susie, but not too Jewish for her father.
I mean, he courted the father.
He went every night to their house, played a ukulele. He bought a ukulele because it was cheap. You know, that was his idea of a musical instrument. And he sat on the porch and talked politics with Susie's father, who was a very conservative Republican, as was Warren at the time, and just courted her father.
And did they pretty quickly have kids? And what did the marriage kind of settle into pretty quickly?
They had children within 2 years. Susie Jr., their first child, was born. And they had a routine that was the 1950s Ozzie and Harriet to an extreme. Susie really didn't understand what Warren did for a living. And he was totally focused on work, and she took care of everything else, everything. And that was the way they both liked it and assumed it. He had a holy mission, investing. He was special, and she understood that.
And at this point, he had started his investing partnership. I mean, pretty early in the marriage, he started what has now become the beginnings of the fortune, an investing partnership where, what, he basically got aunts and uncles and, you know, a couple relatives to invest.
Mm-hmm. In 1956, there were six people who joined him to start this first partnership. They put in a total of $105,000.
And they were all relatives.
They were all a couple of friends, a college roommate, his aunt, you know, his father-in-law.
He had no reputation at that point.
Nobody knew who he was, yeah.
And how quickly was he able to start compounding that money to where it started to get noticed?
The first year, he beat the market by 4%, and the second year by a lot more than that. And so by 1960, which was a watershed year, 4 years later, investors were coming in droves, and he was going to New York and raising money. He would have sit-downs, and dozens of people would come, and by then he had, I believe, over 100 partners, and by the late 1960s, he had over 300 partners. The partnership was growing very
But literally,
fast.
Here's a kid from Omaha who's just starting out an investment partnership in what, 56, 57, and by 60, the reputation is starting to get around.
Yes. It was not long before his partnership was bigger than Ben Graham's. Ben Graham, his mentor, had a $6.5 million partnership, and, you know, Warren's was bigger than that by the early 1960s.
And what was he investing in then?
He bought what he called cigar butts, which were crummy companies where the idea was that it was like a cigar butt discarded on the ground and you could pick it up for free and just suck one last puff out of it. So he would buy companies that were usually in trouble of some sort, but they were so cheap that you could bet that they would become, you know, from nearly worthless to a little bit less worthless, and then you could sell the stock.
Or they could liquidate and you could sort of make a little bit of money on that.
Yeah, maybe the assets on sale and liquidation would be worth a little bit more than the stock was trading.
This was basically a hedge fund. This partnership?
It was. He charged fees like a hedge fund. He charged a percentage of his profits, and he took a quarter of all the money that he earned for investors. Although, notably, he did not charge a management fee. So if he didn't make money for the partners, he didn't get paid anything, unlike the hedge funds of today.
It is true that most of those early people, even in 60 and 63, the bulk of the people that invested in this partnership were sort of part of the Omaha circle, weren't they? The word had gotten out around Omaha, and some doctors and some people had some money were suddenly putting big bucks his way.
The first couple of years, yes.
It wasn't like Shearson or someone was New York giving him $1 million.
No. It was, the money came in 5,000 at a time, 10,000 at a time, and it wasn't until the 1960s that it came in 50,000. He got a few chunks of 50,000 or so, but the big money didn't come until he'd been in business for quite a while.
And the famed investment, the vehicle that we all know today, was this small textile mill in New Bedford, Massachusetts, I believe, called Berkshire Hathaway.
Berkshire Hathaway.
Whatever intrigues him about a textile mill in New Bedford, Massachusetts?
It was cheap.
It was a cigar butt?
It was a cigar butt, and it was one that he had been studying. And his idea was to buy some stock, and then the company was doing repurchasing stock. He thought he'd get it cheap, sell it back to them at a little higher. So his idea was not to buy Berkshire Hathaway, but to actually sell it.
And I think the stock didn't do anything. If it went down even, I think, didn't it?
Yeah, but the company would periodically, they would tender for it. It would go down, and then they would tender for it a little higher price. And so his idea was they'd tender. He'd pay 7, they'd tender at 11.
I heard him say once that it was one of the worst investments he had ever made.
He told me
Berkshire Hathaway.
He said he told me that he wished he had never heard of Berkshire Hathaway.
The point being that it at the time, in 1965, was sort of asset-heavy and a bunch of textiles and an industry that was already beginning to move overseas.
Yes, it was a doomed business because it was unable to compete with foreign labor even then. And so inevitably the competition overseas was going to kill it. And that was, you could see that then.
So he didn't do anything but lose money on the Berkshire Hathaway business.
From the day he bought it. It had one profitable quarter, I think, or half a year, maybe, in the whole life.
So then how does Berkshire Hathaway, which he buys as a textile mill in New Bedford that makes no money and is going downhill fast, become, basically the largest fortune in the world?
Well, this is one of Warren's secrets, is what he did is he began liquidating it and moving the cash. So they closed down a mill, they sold plant equipment, took the money, bought something else. And the first big thing he bought was an insurance company called National Indemnity. And that was a great business. And that gave him money to buy other companies.
And so over time, he squirrels a little money away from textiles and starts building up this other stuff. And so the textiles ends up, eventually closed everything down.
It just shriveled away to nothing. But the concept that he figured out was that if you've got a business that's throwing off cash, you can use that to buy more businesses that will throw off cash. You can use that to buy more. And so it becomes this virtuous circle of profits.
Is it just an accident that Berkshire became his vehicle?
I don't think so, because his friends said that he seemed to have some sort of mysterious attachment to Berkshire Hathaway. And no one ever really understood what that was. But even though he wishes he'd never heard of it, he seemed to want to own it and be very fond of it.
Because he kept buying stock in it, even as the textile business was absolutely tanking.
Yes. Yes.
And I assume the stock kept going down. He, for whatever reason, was obsessed and kept buying some more in his personal account for the partnership and everything.
Yes. Even when it made no sense, he kept buying it.
Somehow he was convinced that that could be a vehicle over time. He knew it wasn't going to be textiles, it was going to make his fortune.
Yeah, and he believed in himself and his own ability to turn it into something worth having.
And over time, that's just grown and grown and grown. It has become a vehicle of all these businesses we know.
Yeah.
See's Candy, Geico Insurance, all the rest. We'll get into more of that. What was his wife doing at this point? Was he just a workaholic?
He was. People said she was sort of a single mother, and he was totally wrapped up in the business.
The classic sort of male of that era that was obsessed with their job.
maybe to an extreme. His friends used to tell jokes. They would say, "Who is that, Warren? That's your son." You know, very extreme.
I think in about 72, Berkshire, some of the money there, ended up buying part of the Washington Post Company.
Yes.
How did he develop into a board member of the Washington Post Company, and what was that relationship like?
Well, he wanted to be a board member of the Post, and he maneuvered Kay Graham into inviting him. She was the chairman of the Post Company, by, in effect, getting his friend Tom Murphy to tell her that she ought to invite him onto the board.
And you write a lot about his relationship with women, and you write a lot about his relationship with Kay Graham, that legendary, you know, chairman of the Post for years through the Pentagon Papers and Watergate and all the rest, when that paper was really made a name for itself. Did they go out?
They did. It's not clear what they did afterwards, but they did go. They did go out. They definitely had a very complicated relationship. They were friends. They had a very romanticized friendship.
I mean, she brought him into that Washington Circle and embassy dinners and White House dinners and all the rest.
Yes, and he taught her about business. She leaned on men for advice, and she didn't have confidence that she knew how to run her own company. And he taught her everything about business and made the Post a very valuable business as a result.
And she was a widow at that point, of course.
She was.
What did his wife think? So Susie Buffett is back in Omaha, and Warren is out at embassy dinners with Kay Graham, and it was being talked about.
Well, up to a point, they had lived a separate life, you know, and up to a point, Susie turned a blind eye because she was pursuing her own pursuits. And then Warren's social life with Kay Graham became so public, it started to make the gossip columns, and it diminished Susie's role. And at that point, it made Susie angry, at least what I was told by people who knew her.
And over time, what did she do?
Well, Susie had a social life of her own. She had a relationship with someone else, and she ended up moving to San Francisco. And she stayed married to Warren, but she lived a long way away from him.
And what do you think of that?
He was devastated. It caught him by surprise, and he was so dependent on her that he would have done anything to get her to come back.
Even though he must have known he was responsible in some ways.
He says that it was the biggest mistake of his life, and he feels that it was preventable.
He could have saved that marriage.
He feels that he could have.
But they never divorced.
No, they never divorced. And, you know, he said it was preventable, but, you know, I don't know that he would have done anything differently. You know, I don't know that he would have been less focused on business. Certainly, he didn't stop seeing Kay Graham after Susie left. You know, he is who he is, but they never divorced. They never divorced. They maintained a public relationship, and he remained very emotionally dependent on her for the rest of her life.
And not too long thereafter, he ended up having another relationship.
Yes.
I mean, basically sort of a live-in wife.
Well, Warren is incapable of living without a day-to-day relationship with a woman. He can't find his own. He doesn't know how to turn on the oven. He used to claim that he couldn't, you know, wash his own hair, and Susie would do it. And so he was despairing when Susie left. She got one of her friends, Astrid Manx, to come over, and Astrid was supposed to, you know, cook a meal or two, and instead they struck up a relationship, which was probably predictable. And 5 months later, Astrid moved in with Warren.
And lived together until his legal wife died?
Yes, and then he married Astrid 2 years later. Essentially, she and Susie split the role of a wife.
And were they fine with that?
They were. I mean, they had roles that were delineated, and, you know, Astrid lived a more confined life, and it was certainly not ideal. I think from any of their perspective, none of them would have, you know, chosen, but it was acceptable to all of them.
What do his kids think of him now? He was very stingy.
They used to say that if their dad took them to the movies, you could never be sure if he would pay for the popcorn. You know, and he was manipulative about money. He would play games with them about money and dangle it in front of them. And he was withholding about money. And as he's gotten older, that has changed a lot. and he's become much more generous. He gives them $1 million every 5 years on their birthday. He used to say they weren't going to inherit anything significantly. He's changed his tune on that. They'll be getting something. But above all, he gave them each $1 billion in a foundation of their own that they could choose what to give away the money to. And his relationship with them over money is a lot healthier now.
They're a little bit happier.
They're more comfortable with him on the subject of money, for sure. Yes.
You spent all this time with them. You've sort of studied the business. You've studied the decisions he's made. What's your takeaway? I mean, why is this guy, this precocious but, you know, troubled kid from Omaha, now the richest man in the world?
Focus. That's what he would say. And I saw it in action. That, you know, with the same intelligence scattered in four or five different directions, he would never have become what he became. But, you know, I lay out what he did to actually become what he became. It was a lot of work. It required, you know, from the time he was 6 years old, constant learning. He's a learning machine. Study. He read everything he could read. He learned everything about every kind of business that he could learn. And he did it out of love. You know, it's his passion, and it was that passion that made him what he is.
And he never stopped looking for deals. He never stopped trying to sort of find the next big prize.
And he still is. He said to me once that intensity is the price of excellence. And he has that same intensity, you know, even now in the middle of a financial crisis. He is going full bore.
Seems like he says he's a kid in the candy shop or something. I mean, he loves when fear takes over, walks in and gets a lot of deals. We tend to think that everything he's invested in has, been a jackpot. I mean, that this guy sort of can't, you know, he's got the Midas touch. Your book, I think one of the most fascinating parts is that you document all these different deals he's made over time. A couple have been absolute clunkers, including Berkshire.
Mm-hmm.
But even the ones we think of that have done well over time, General Re, some of the insurance holdings, even, you know, Geico for a while, had very troubled years. I mean, every investment he's made has had a tough patch.
At some point or another, yes. One of the most fascinating things I learned is that, you know, despite being an insurance genius, and that's been the source of most of the money to buy everything else, essentially every insurance company he's ever bought, and there are a few dozens, has fallen off a cliff and done badly right after he bought it, and then it's turned around. That was a revelation. But he uses a margin of safety. So he builds into the price of everything he buys a wide range for error, and he buys at a big discount, and that saved him over and over and over, and that's a big lesson from his life.
What unites the kinds of things he buys?
He likes to buy things that are stable. They're not going to be obsolete. He buys shoe companies, furniture companies, brick makers, insurance companies. People will still be buying those products 50 years from now. So they're predictable. He can look out in the future and see what their cash flows will be. They're quantifiable. He understands them. And they're fundamentally good businesses. And then he likes the price.
He's famous for not investing in technology.
Yes.
Best friend in the world seems to be Bill Gates and doesn't own any Microsoft.
Right. He understands technology. Bill Gates has taught him a lot about technology. That was one of the things I learned writing this book. He has a reputation of being a dimwit about technology. He's not at all. But he doesn't understand technology as well as a professional technology investor or an engineer. And, you know, he likes to be the casino, not the chump at the table. And he likes to know more than anybody else.
He likes to be the house.
He likes to be the house. And he's not in technology investing. He's not. And technology becomes obsolete.
Did he see this crisis coming?
Yes, he did. He did. In 2002, he warned that derivatives are financial weapons of mass destruction. And he couldn't say when, but that something like this would happen. And in 2004, he actually started talking to me about the housing market and being very concerned about that. And then in last spring, when Bear Stearns was being acquired by J.P. Morgan, he talked at some length about the dominoes that could fall. And the last chapter of this book, I included a conversation that I had with him where he says that if Bear Stearns went and then Lehman Brothers went, and then Merrill Lynch went, and he essentially prophesied exactly what would happen now, and he said, in this situation, the government would not have very many good alternatives. It was eerie, you know, that the hairs rose on the back of my neck, and, you know, it's all come to pass.
Has he been right about most of those kind of macro calls?
I can't think of one where he's ever been wrong on these big macro calls.
And right now, I mean, this literal day, he's making another macro call, actually, isn't he?
He said to buy stocks.
Today in the New York Times, did an op-ed piece?
Yes. He said to buy stocks, that in 10 years, you'd be happy if you did that. They might not do, you know, the next year might not be great, but, you know, 10 years from now, buy stocks.
And what's the reaction to Wall Street about his call today?
There's been a lot of press, but they haven't been up. The market was up 140 when we were walking in here. Not much.
But you think most, I mean, are most of your former colleagues saying, oh, he's early?
I think so. Or, oh, he's being self-serving. He owns stocks, so he's talking up the market. That kind of thing gets said a lot when he makes a call. It's not true.
He likes to say that they kind of steer clear of any kind of legal questionable activities. And this goes into kind of the teaching role I think he thinks he and Berkshire plays.
Mm-hmm.
That they want to be model citizens. He's not about just making as much money as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Has he in effect kind of taken a hit financially because he hasn't pushed it to the limit?
He has. There have been times, for sure. You know, his life story from the time he was shoplifting forward, he actually stole his sister's bicycle at one point. It's always been a bit of a war between his avarice and his higher principles. And over time, the higher principles have gotten the upper hand more and more of the time as his urge to teach has really driven a lot of that. And Berkshire is really a model that shows that you can make money by, as he puts it, playing in the center of the court. He could have been a hedge fund manager and charged extortionate fees for mediocre performance, and he didn't. He could have done leverage buyouts or started a venture capital fund. He could have done hostile takeovers. We did a calculation. We think his net worth could probably be tens of billions, even maybe double what it is, if he had bought and sold the companies within Berkshire and been more aggressive and less principled.
And what are those principles that stop him from doing that? I mean, in agreement, what? He buys companies, I know he doesn't
like
to.
When he buys companies, he doesn't sell them. He has a compact with these companies that he doesn't trade them like the...
Meaning when he buys the whole company. We should say he owns Benbridge Jeweler.
Yeah.
This is one of the companies
yeah.
he doesn't.
When he buys a business, he doesn't sell it. That's the compact he makes with the management. He doesn't use large amounts of debt to finance deals because he doesn't want to expose his shareholders to that risk. So Berkshire, had it leveraged up, could have made a lot more money at certain times. He's never done that, but it might have been lucrative at times. He's never done a hostile takeover. You know, there's times when he could have been very aggressive in pushing to buy companies that maybe were not, you know, and that might have made more money for Berkshire. And the most important thing is he closed down his investment partnership. He runs Berkshire, and he doesn't get a fee for doing that. He got 25% of all the returns he earned when he ran his partnership, his hedge fund. He gets nothing for managing the assets of Berkshire Hathaway. The hedge fund managers that are, in effect, competing with him are taking, you know, 20-25%, raking that off every single year, and he's not.
Because no doubt tomorrow he could start a hedge fund and get $100 billion, you know,
yes.
overnight
yes.
and get 20% of that or whatever. It is a decision to send a signal to the hedge fund industry, is it not?
It is.
I don't like what you do is basically yes. what he's saying.
Yes, and he said a number of times, if I were working with a smaller amount of money, I could earn higher returns. He could have liquidated Berkshire Hathaway at various points and then just raised up a new fund and started over as a hedge fund. He would have made a lot more money. He didn't do it.
I mean, Berkshire is a moral cause.
It is for him. It is.
And I remember reading some of his earlier reports. I mean, he talked about not having leverage and, you know, not having too much debt. And obviously, you know, we see the effects of debt and the disaster it has created. I tend to think that was a teaching lesson. Not just, I don't like risk, but I want the world to notice we can make a fortune here without any debt to speak of.
That is absolutely true. And the importance of him being the world's richest man, in a sense, is that it is a validation that these concepts, that fundamental value matters, not taking on a lot of debt is the way to get rich. You know, we can see that it works because he has survived and surmounted the mountain, and he's outlasted everybody, and he's at the top.
Does he kind of feel like Bill Gates is his third son?
Absolutely. He does.
I mean, was he kind of... I don't want to disparage his son, so maybe I won't go that question, but... I don't know. I suppose every family, you know, if you're a successful businessman, you want to hand it off to your kids. Has there been that attempt to sort of get his kids involved in his business? And has he sort of accepted maybe that's not going to be the case?
He did, you know, have an interest in getting his sons involved. But, you know, Howie wants to be a farmer. Peter is very talented musically. And Warren is not the type to force people to do what they don't want to do. So after it became clear that that wasn't where their interests lie, you know, then he didn't push. And Bill, he have this very sweet, warm relationship that's really, really nice to see. And they connect on a different level. And it's not a replacement for his sons, but it's as if he just gained another one.
I mean, are the kids kind of jealous of Bill Gates?
I think there is a little bit of tension there, yes.
Not that he's getting the money, but that he's, maybe there's jealousy of that too, but that there's a lot of time he spends up here and around the world with Bill Gates.
When they were young, they suffered from Warren's lack of attention, and Warren now has a number of friends who are about their age, and so you would naturally feel that...
Number of friends the kid's age.
Of his own children's age. And so his attention is still very divided, and he's far more attentive now to his own children than he ever was when they were young. But nevertheless, you know, naturally, you know, you would feel, you know, I want my share, and, you know, you didn't get it when you were a child, and then here's somebody my own age, and
getting
it's
a
my
lot
father's
of
best friend.
But yeah. You do get the sense, and you kind of allude to it, that he may be making up for past sins.
There's a lot
of attention he is trying to pay now. Mm-hmm. And even I think he did later in Susie's life, his wife's life.
He did. From the time that she moved to San Francisco, he almost couldn't do enough for her. And it was very clear in the time that I spent observing him that, you know, anything that she asked for, anything except giving her as much money as she wanted, he would do. And they tussled over money all the time. But other than that, you know, she ruled.
How much money did she want?
Well, I can't give you a number, but, you know, she was always the spender. And they had a game. You know, it was almost a game between them. It was almost entertainment that she liked tugging him, making him give her money, and he sort of liked withholding it, and that was their game.
And we should talk about this. He's notoriously frugal. I mean, this is not a guy that has lavished, really, in effect, spent any... I don't think he's sold a share of Berkshire Hathaway. He has, in effect, never realized anything in the way of lifestyle change from his $50 billion.
Right.
Never spent a cent of it, and never going to on himself.
No. You know, he has personal money that he invests and uses to live on, but not Berkshire. And there's, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, Berkshire is an external manifestation of himself. You know, it would be like cutting off his arm to sell Berkshire stock. He can't do it. You know, that was why it was such a monumental thing for him to begin giving the shares away to the Gates Foundation. He's very frugal by nature. He has that depression in childhood background. He also just doesn't really care about material things. He really doesn't, you know.
You have this great story. He used to stay in Kay Graham's apartment in D.C., and I think it was Sharon Osbourne, so one of his friends ended up staying there, too, and she says, "Oh, Warren, there's a Picasso in the bathroom. What'd you think of that?" And he said, "Well, I've been staying there 30 years. I didn't even notice the Picasso in the bathroom. I noticed the free shampoo, but I didn't notice the Picasso."
So. Exactly.
Yeah. What did he say to you about philanthropy and this whole... You were probably around him quite a bit when this decision was made to give it to, you know, our guy.
I was. In fact, there were all kinds of little clues and hints dropped. He started talking to me and saying, "You know, I think that Bill and Melinda Gates are the best philanthropists on earth. You know, it might be... I wonder what would happen if I gave, you know, them some of the money." And floating little trial balloons. And he was doing this for several years before he actually made the decision. First, he thought about giving them some of the money after he died, instead of putting it in his own foundation. And then the plan became giving it to them before he died, which was a huge shift. He had always assumed that his wife, Susie, would handle everything because he always assumed he would die first.
And they had this agreement that
she would take care of the money And when she died of a stroke in 2004, that changed everything.
Because suddenly he was going to be the one that was going to be living longer.
And so within a year of that, he came up with this plan and chose the Gates Foundation as the largest recipient of his funds and decided to begin giving the money away now.
You know, I can't help to think there's such a teaching aspect to that, too, because here's a man who, you know, could set up the Buffett Foundation. It would be the largest foundation in the world. It would surpass Gates if he poured all the money into it tomorrow. And yet, he ends up thinking, you know, I would have probably just done exactly what Bill Gates and Melinda are doing. And they took 10 years to start it up and made all the errors, and they're finally into sort of a rhythm that works. Why not just endow that and forget my name on a foundation?
Yes. And, you know, he was able to set his ego aside. He cares a lot about efficiency, and they were the only foundation that's ever been able to give away these enormous sums of money. And it mattered to him that it be done right, and it be done by people he trusted, and he trusts them implicitly.
Did you like him?
Warren?
Yeah.
Oh, I just adore Warren. I also have wanted to strangle him at times, but, you know, I...
Because? You
know, because he can be very frustrating. He doesn't listen. He says that, you know, I get up in the morning, I look in the mirror, and at that point, everybody's had their say. And, you know, and so when you're writing a book with him, you know, you're talking to him about different things, and he's saying that, you know, his idea of going on a diet is having two chocolate milkshakes and nothing else, and you're like, Warren, you know, and he doesn't. So there's a type of journalism called immersion journalism, and to some extent I was doing that. I was, you know, I was along for the ride, but I was the observer. And I had to step back and detach myself.
I mean, did you go to parties with him? Did you... No.
No. In fact, the Sun Valley, which is the first major chapter of the book, which is a big conference, I reported it. So I sneaked into it, and, you know, I hid behind the bushes, and he never knew I was there.
He does seem to like women.
Yes.
Is it not a surprise a woman was chosen to write his authorized biography?
It's not a surprise. I think that he would never have been comfortable telling all of these very personal things to a man. I think that's true.
Who was the most interesting other person to talk to about him?
Well, his immediate family, of course, his sisters, and Bill Gates and Charlie Munger were fascinating to talk to about him for different reasons.
Why?
Well, Charlie is just this intellectually brilliant.
This is his,
yes,
his sort of partner.
His partner. So Charlie has known him for, you know, 50 years, intellectually brilliant, and this incredible curmudgeon who just says whatever he wants. So he is the one who told me that Warren was an implacable acquirer, like John D. Rockefeller in the early days of building his empire, who let nothing get in his way. You know, Charlie had some of the best lines in the book. Bill Gates was fascinating to talk to because he gave me an insight into Warren's thinking about philanthropy and about business, and in recent years, the speed with which Warren has learned the modern business era. And Bill is just fun to talk to. You know, you ask him questions and it's just like, you know.
And you got full access, full green light. No one held back. He clearly sent the message, Alice is legit.
Nobody important, everybody important interviewed with me. Everybody I needed.
What about the people on Wall Street? I mean, some of the people have done deals with them. Does anyone not like this guy?
There are people who resent him.
Because?
Because he's so successful and because somehow he always wins. You know, he always comes out on top. He always wins. And there's also a certain resentment that he does do some preaching. You know, he gets out and he makes statements. And he has a disdain for Wall Street. And yet he is part of it in a way. And there are people who feel that that's a bit hypocritical. You know, he makes money off doing, you know, off investing. You know, he owns part of Goldman Sachs now, and yet he derides Wall Street. You know, so there's some resentment of that, yes.
Does anyone feel like they were, you know, really railroaded by him?
Yes. You know, Warren has a way of being relentless when he wants something. And, you know, what I said in the book is that he's needy to the point that when he really feels he needs something, he just takes it. And when he was acquiring Berkshire Hathaway stock and the component pieces of it, you know, even with his friends, he would just say, he would call up Walter Schloss, one of his friends, and he'd say, "Walter, I want your stock." And Walter would say, "Well, I don't see why I should give it to you." And Warren would say, "I need it. You know, give it to me." And his friends would acquiesce. He had a way of getting them to give in. You know, and I've heard other stories like that. You know, he has a way of just demanding, and people give. That's why I said I went to strangle him sometimes.
No. Does he watch CNBC? Does he sort of pay attention to the ticker? How sort of obsessed is he with stock prices?
He really only looks at stock prices because he's got a list in his mind of what he might want to buy, and he's looking to see if anything has passed his screen. You know, but things he owns, he's really not focusing on their daily fluctuations.
What's the best investment he ever made?
Geico.
The insurer,
which he bought the first half of at, you know, $2 a share. And the second half he paid a lot of money for, but it averaged out because it's been so profitable. It's grown so much, the best investment. Washington Post, probably the second best.
I think it's fascinating. Many people don't know this, but his, you know, the world headquarters of Berkshire Hathaway at Omaha, on the 12th floor of some building, has, I don't know, maybe 20 employees, maybe it's 25 now. I mean, this, you know, one of the largest corporations in America is run by 25 people.
Yes. Some of that is because Warren is the PR department, and Warren doesn't like to be scheduled, so there is no investor relations. He is the investor relations. Then there are things that are outsourced. The subsidiaries do their own human resources. They do their own legal work. They do their, you know, internal audit is outsourced. He doesn't like to have a lot of people around him.
No internal legal counsel, no HR, none of that.
None of that.
I mean, how is it going to succeed him?
Well, the next CEO is going to have to change some of those things and probably be criticized for doing it, but shouldn't be, because without Warren, it's going to have to become a little bit more like a conventional corporation. You know, not everybody can have the razzle-dazzle showmanship of him. They're going to need somebody to interface with, you know, the public, things like that.
And is he, what kind of premium do you think there is, the Buffett premium on this stock? Like when he dies, what happens?
I think the stock will go down when he dies, but I think it will recover. At different times, the stock actually has a discount because of him. It's not always at a premium. And although I'm not an analyst anymore, so I don't value the stock, so I can't tell you right now, do I think it's over or undervalued, but I don't think that people right now value the stock based on him all the time. At a time like this, maybe, but not all the time.
As we close here, he has at many times looked foolish in terms of the kind of bets he makes and the kind of bets he doesn't make. He certainly wasn't in the dot-com boom, didn't do technology whenever it was doing technology, walked into some bad investments in insurance, you know, bought U.S. Air and it immediately tanked. What kind of personality has he had that over time he hasn't changed with the direction of the winds? He's had this kind of one style and it does work out.
He calls it the inner scorecard. And he has this way of establishing a principle, thinking through it, sticking with it. He's very rational, and he is not influenced by what other people think when it comes to money, investing, and business. He just doesn't care. So when other people are panicking, when other people are excited, he just keeps on doing, and his life is a testament to 78 years of consistency.
I mean, this is a guy that has a lot of self-confidence. I mean, it's not that easy to have, you know, not bought one piece of technology during the late 90s.
And during the internet bubble, because he's personally sensitive, he was really suffering from the criticism that people were saying he was a has-been and passé, and yet he still did not change his style, never considered deviating from his investment principles, no matter how upset he was by the criticism. I think that's remarkable.
So what do you do now?
Well, I'd like to first go on my honeymoon because I got married in April and my husband David Moyer and I have not had much time off. And then I'm sure I'll continue writing. But this is going to be hard to top. And so I'm not sure what I'll write next.
Hard to top because why?
It was a fun project about somebody who's really interesting, and he's an American icon, and the richness of the material was fun to work with, and people were really helpful at telling me funny stories about him. You know, it was entertaining to do, and I liked working on it. You know, there are a lot of people who are really interesting people, but I don't know that it would be as much fun, and I think this is a fun book. I want to do something fun.
You're not going back to Wall Street.
I don't expect to be an analyst, no. Not ever again.
Will you do a follow-up? I mean, this guy's, you know, the last chapter has not been written.
That's correct. I do expect that this will need an update at some point. So I think so, yes.
But after five, well, did you expect to be spending 5 years on it?
No, I underestimated. I thought it would take a couple of years. I was naive.
And so do you feel partly that you want to kind of take a break, that after a long time of sort of living and breathing Warren Buffett?
I do. I know that I will be living and breathing Warren Buffett forever to some extent because, you know, I've got a file room in my house full of his papers and I've got his life stored in my head. But I'd like to take a break and do something different.
Did people come to you and ask you this very question, which I'm going to ask, which is, so what's Warren saying now? You know, you talked to him this morning. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know.
And I don't want to be his spokesman. You know, really only he can speak for himself. And so we all know his principles, and I know his life, and I can tell you what he thinks in general. But, you know, I don't want to be the backdoor way that people try to get to Warren Buffett.
Even though you do have a relationship with him and talk to him, you know, a fair amount.
I do talk to him, but, you know, it's in, you know, the book was hard for him, and so, you know, not as much as I used to. We'll see how that goes.
Book is hard, meaning?
It's hard to read something like this about your life, and, you know, I hope it'll normalize over time, but, you know, it's been difficult.
I mean, you feel that there's some tension.
I wouldn't say tension. I think that, you know, when we've talked, we've just put this on the back burner. We've talked about other things. We've talked about the market, you know, and I think that as time passes, I hope that, you know, things go back to the way they were and we just, you know, it becomes light and easy. But right now, you know, he's watching people pick him apart just like we're doing here. Think how that would feel if it were you. That would be tough.
I'm glad Alice hasn't written my book.
Exactly.
And speaking of books, Alice will be signing them right here for all of you. Let's give her a big Seattle thank you. She was great. Thank you so much.
This program was presented by the Seattle Public Library. It was made possible by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. The Library Foundation represents thousands of people in our community who make gifts, large and small, to help us buy books and materials for the collections, to present free public programs, to provide programs and services for Seattle's immigrant and refugee community, and to support early learning so that children are ready for school. For more information on these podcasts, please visit our website, www.spl.org.